He took one or two steps forward and reached for my door handle, which was locked. And about the time he grabbed it, I yelled, "Stop." He took his right hand off my door handle, looked right at me, and yelled, "I got something for you." And then he reached behind his right hip.
Hey gang, if you're listening to this right now, odds are you watch videos on the main channel and you've seen how important speed and accuracy are in a gunfight. That's why Active Self-Protection recommends a Range Tech shot timer. I'll tell you, it's the lowest cost shot timer on the market that we're aware of, Bluetooth compatible with any Android or iOS device. More features than any other shot timer. You can store all your data on the cloud for free. That's free. Native integration with PracticeScore and a visual light-based ghost signal. Visit them at rangetechtimer.com, rangetechtimer.com, and tell them your friends at the Active Self-Protection Podcast sent you.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Active Self-Protection Podcast. I am once again your host, Mike Williver, and I remain your favorite former Fed. With us today, he's going to say this, he's a big fan of the podcast, folks. He's the first guy to have on. He's like, it's a really good podcast, and I couldn't agree with him strongly or quickly enough about that. It is a great podcast. His name is Mike. He is from Missouri, married with five adult kids, and we'll talk about that as much or as little as he wants. And he has a story that is of interest to, I think, to everyone, and with some good lessons. That story happened a while back in scenic Memphis, Tennessee. And if you've been to Memphis, you know, well, it's Memphis, isn't it? Mike, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Again, you know, I say it every week. If people didn't reach out with their stories, there wouldn't be a podcast because no one wants to listen to me talk for an hour. But Mike was good enough and frankly courageous enough to reach out and talk to me. And it turns out the story is, in fact, it's a good one and has some really good lessons. So we'll get to that in just a moment. First of all, Mike, you seem like someone who has been invested in your own self-defense and shooting and that sort of thing long before you ever saw an ASP video. So kind of tell us about when did you kind of become aware of the need for you to protect yourself and start doing stuff about it?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest. My dad had guns. We had them in the house. It wasn't a big thing, but I grew up hunting and rabbit hunting. Eventually up to deer hunting, turkey hunting, that kind of thing. And once I went into the Navy, went in 1986, I got a little more interested in handgun shooting and kind of progressed from there and worked in a series of gun shops while I was in the Navy, different places where we were stationed.
Okay.
And started doing some competition shooting. In particular, we lived in Charleston, South Carolina. Had a lot of fun with that. Kind of had aspirations to become a police officer. Unfortunately, my Navy career was cut short because I messed up my right knee. And then once I got out, that kind of kept me from pursuing that. Stuck with shooting. And I got my first carry permit. I want to say I was 21 or 22 years old. So I've been carrying for quite a long time through a series of different, you know, carry pistols. So I would say I've always been interested in hunting and firearms, and then the self-defense aspect of it really took off around 21, 22 years old, and I'm going to be 56 next month.
So. Well, you don't look a day over 55, Mike. I don't know how you do it. Probably just clean living. That's my dad's joke. Sorry.
It must be.
So you mentioned the Navy. I always like to ask folks that were in the service. First of all, thank you for your service, and I mean that. My dad was a sub-skipper, Annapolis grad, and you know I have some idea of what it's like to work for Uncle Sam's canoe club, as it were, as John likes to say.
Yep.
He made hot water the hard way, something like that. Anyway, so what is it you did in the Navy exactly, Mike?
I was a fire control technician, and sometimes you tell people that and they think, oh, you were a fireman. We were actually the guys that maintained and repaired and operated a lot of the equipment that was weapons. Basically, my first ship was a battleship. It was the USS Wisconsin. Hmm. Kind of the dream posting for a fire control technician. Everything on that ship was designed to blow stuff up.
Right.
It's fantastic. And then from there, went to a ship that weighed, I think, just about as much as one of the 16-inch turrets on the Wisconsin. So it was a vast difference.
No kidding.
And that was actually the ship that I went through Desert Storm on instead of the one that would have probably handled anything. So that was, I mean, and I mainly took care of radars was my main function in that rate. That transferred into what I did after the Navy too, since police force didn't work out for me.
Right. Yeah. So were you ever on board a ship like the Wisconsin that had those enormous guns on turrets that fired and moved the entire ship till it almost capsized? Were you ever present for that? Cause that looks like it would have been an unreal experience to see that firsthand.
I was in the main battery division for the fire control and weapons department. I actually got to fire the 16-inch guns on the Wisconsin about 32 times.
Wow. Okay. So folks who are keeping track at home, think about a 9mm round. That's 9mm. So if you can wrap your head around what the size, just the width, the circumference of a 16-inch round or, you know, munition would be, it's big. Yep. You know, the joke my dad used to say was that they basically shoot a Volkswagen Beetle out of a gun onto whatever it is they're aiming at. And just the United States Navy is the finest Navy in the history of the world. It's unbelievable capability. And, you know, if you're a tin pot dictator somewhere, what you don't want is the United States Naval Fleet, what do they call that group with, you know, that has the aircraft carrier and then all the other attendant ships.
That would be a carrier battle group.
There you go. A battle group. You do not want a United States battle group off your shore. That's a bad feeling. So you were in the Navy. Then when you left, the police thing didn't work out because of medical reasons. So what is the first thing you ended up doing? Because I think it was sort of related to your job in the Navy.
Yeah, I basically was kind of looking for something that I could transfer the skills the Navy taught me into, and wound up going into broadcasting, TV and radio, basically maintaining the transmitters for television stations or radio stations, because they are basically a radar without a receiver. Your television or your radio is the receiver for them. They're very, very similar.
Yeah, so out west, at least, I know the top of every, the highest peak around your city or town would tend to have a bunch of, is that what that was on top of there, all those big, tall, with the lights on them? Okay.
Yep.
Interesting. And then after that, you went into something also kind of similar in the same general wheelhouse. So tell us about that, your current employment. What is it you do now?
I'm a field service engineer for a medical device company, and they're called linear accelerators, and they're used for radiation cancer treatment. And believe it or not, they are also very similar to radars in the way that they operate and the components that they have.
Very interesting. So if you or someone you love has had a radiation treatment, it's very likely that one of the machines that Mike is affiliated with was present for that. Repeat, just before we got started, you said to me, when someone asks you what is it you do, and you said this line, what was it you said?
I said the most accurate way to describe it, but sometimes comes off sounding kind of pretentious, is that I maintain and repair linear subatomic particle accelerators.
Yes. And I think I said something like, that sounds like the thing in the middle of the DeLorean that powers the time machine. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure that was too funny to not let the folks in on. So a little callback for you. All right. So I think it's safe to say that you're a pretty smart guy, because dumb guys don't get to do jobs like that. So we've established that Mike is a smart guy. So what do you have? You have two smart mics on the same podcast, and that's exciting. So, so your story did not happen in Missouri. It happened in Memphis. So did you live in Memphis or around the Memphis area at the time, or were you visiting?
Yes. We lived in Memphis for about 22 years, roughly. And this took place in, was the first couple of weeks, first half of January of 2009.
Okay. And about when did you leave Memphis for greener pastures?
March of this year.
Okay. So when you first got there, was it a crime-free paradise, or was it already kind of what it is now?
No, which is unfortunate. It wasn't a crime-free paradise, but it wasn't by any means what it is now.
Okay.
They weren't 200 police officers short and, you know, 348 murders every year kind of a thing going on.
And that, for the population of Memphis, that's just an abysmal statistic. I lived
600,000 people.
Yeah, that's huge. I remember living in D.C. in the late 80s and early 90s when it was the murder capital. I should say I didn't live in D.C. I lived in a suburb just outside. you could throw a rock from where I lived and it would land in DC. So close enough. And it was the murder capital of the world at the time. And they had 400 and something murders. And it was fewer than 500,000 people lived in the district at the time. And everybody knew that 90% of those homicides happened in one quarter of the district, which is the Southeast and some in the Northeast. And, you know, a lack of police, not enough cops to patrol the streets does make a difference in so many ways. If you ever seen like The Wire, for example, the TV show The Wire on HBO, you see the internal politics of a police department dealing with a high crime rate, especially a high homicide rate. And it's very illustrative of the sort of politics that go on behind the scenes of like, let's get these numbers down. And it's not out of any sort, I hate to say this, not out of any sort of concern for actual people being killed in the street, but for things like the mayor's reelection or the city council's reelection. We want to show progress and sell the massage numbers and do all sorts of crazy stuff. But yeah, that's an insane number of homicides for a population that small. So kind of walk us through what you were doing the day of the incident and what happened in your own words, Mike.
Well, where I worked, the maintenance shop, we all took turns on a kind of a monthly basis buying coffee or, you know, whatever for the shop. And it was my turn and decided on my lunch break one day to go to the closest big box store to get a nice big tub of coffee.
Okay.
And, drove out there and got my coffee. And as I was leaving, I decided to take advantage of their low-priced gasoline at their gas station.
Okay.
And pulled up. I had a 94 Jeep Cherokee at the time. I love Jeep Cherokee. Mm-hmm. And was in the process of filling up. And it was cold, but it wasn't crazy freezing out. This particular big box store has a McDonald's in front of it. It's on Getwell Road. It's still there. And I can remember standing by the back driver's side of the Jeep, filling up. And what caught my attention was a guy walking out of the McDonald's parking lot toward me. And he was dressed kind of flamboyantly. He had a very shiny coat on, but it wasn't on his shoulders. It was hanging down off his, you know, onto his elbows. Mm-hmm. Very big, kind of baggy jeans on.
So he's this guy's dressed for a job interview at a Fortune 500 company.
Indeed.
Okay.
And he was waving his arms and yelling, "Hey, hey." And he was looking at me as he was walking toward me. And I remember thinking, you know, what is this going to be? Mm-hmm. And having lived in Memphis for a long time and knowing some of the stuff that goes on, the first thing I did was I stepped to the very back of the Jeep and kind of stepped over to where the right-hand side of me was behind the back of the Jeep. He could only see the left-hand side of me. And I remember looking around to make sure nobody else was coming up from any place, because that's a fairly common thing. Somebody will get your attention and somebody else will walk up behind you and hit you. Nobody else was coming up.
Okay.
So I didn't know what was going on. So I was watching this guy. And as he got more or less right at the front of the Jeep, I put my hand up and I told him to stop. And I said it pretty forcefully. And I think that kind of caught him by surprise. He wasn't expecting that. Mm-hmm. And I remember he had an unlit cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And I told him to stop. And I said, what do you want? And he wanted to know if I had a light. And I'm mind you, I'm standing there pumping gas. Right. And I said, no. I said, I don't smoke. And I said, you know, even if I did have, I'm pumping gas. I'm not giving you a light. Well, that set him off. He got real mad, started yelling, called me a bunch of names and everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm just watching him. And I remember having my hand on my gun, which was inside the waistband holster on my right hip.
Okay.
And thinking, don't do anything. Just walk away.
Is he able to, could you tell if he was able to see that you were armed at that point, or was he not aware?
No. Okay. No, he could not tell because that half of me was still behind the Jeep. And that was the whole reason I did that, was so that I could do that without kind of escalating things, possibly.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
He took one or two steps forward and reached for my door handle, which was locked. And about the time he grabbed it, I yelled stop again, much more loud that time, and told him to you know, get out of here or back off, something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And this is where, even in my memory, things kind of go into slow motion, but it all happened so fast at the same time. Which
absolutely
interesting. He took his right hand off my door handle and looked right at me and yelled, "I got something for you." And then he reached behind his right hip.
Oh, boy.
And I'm telling you, Mike, I swear I don't remember drawing. All I remember is coming out from behind the Jeep and basically coming up and starting to get a sight picture on this guy. And he realized what was going on, too. And just about the time that I remember thinking, I really don't want to have to kill anybody, mm-hmm. I saw his shoulders dip and him start to turn. And it wasn't, having done competition shooting and stuff like that, it didn't trigger to me that he was drawing anything. What it made me think was he's turning to run. And he did. He okay. turned directly away from me and ran and went to the left. And as quickly as everything happened, it was suddenly over. And I'm standing there with a gun in my hand. And I look to my left, and the guy on the other side of the gas pump is standing there looking at me with, you know, eyes this big.
I bet.
And I remember saying to him, I said, "Hey, man, did you just see all that?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, I'm going to have to call the cops. Can you hang around?" And he said, "Nope." And he got in his car and drove away.
God, don't ever change, Memphis. Whatever you do, don't ever change.
Yeah. So I reholster. I call, you know, 911. It was amazing how fast the officer got there. And I found out later he was actually on the other side of the parking lot doing paperwork or admin stuff or something. And he realized, you know, it was right there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was on the phone and all of a sudden, boom, there's a cruiser pulling up. And I was like, holy cow. Not what I expected.
So let me stop you right there, because there's a couple things I want to talk about. I'm still working out the format here, folks. It's only been 2 years since we started this podcast. But I don't want to wait until the end to talk about a couple of things. So thing number one is I would have said, "Hey, great job, Mike, on being observant, you know, of looking around, paying attention." But I don't think you had much choice. This guy was trying to get your attention. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Absolutely. So he got your attention. I get the feeling that you probably aren't the sort of person to have your head in your phone or to be looking at the ground, though, when you're refueling, no matter what part of town you're in. Then my question is, what kind of part of town was this? Can you describe it? Was it high crime, very low crime, somewhere between?
I would say at the time in 2009, this was a moderately high crime rate area. Right next to the big box store that I was at was the Memphis Jaguar dealership. Few years later, they relocated way out in a suburb because of how many times they got broken into overnight.
Yeah.
So it's gotten worse. But at the time, it wasn't great.
And I can almost guarantee that most, what do you call a native of Memphis? Is there a word for it? Like Memphians or something?
Memphian, yep.
Are you serious? Oh, I was guessing.
Yep, you got it.
Memphian. I guarantee you at least half of the Memphians pronounced it Jaguar. But that's a story for a different time.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so you turn to this other guy and you're like, "Hey, did you see that?" He acknowledges, "Yeah, I did." And you said, "Can you hang out?" And he says, "Nope." Expect that, folks. If you're listening to this, expect that to happen. Expect other people to not want to be involved in any way in your incident, whether it's helping you because you're getting your butt kicked or just sticking around long enough to be a witness or at least leaving you his number. Be like, "Yeah, I'm late for work, but here's my number. Have the police call me." No, none of that. So the question is then, how aggressive are you about getting witness information? Do you take his tag number down and give it to the cops? I wouldn't, only because he's already shown a thorough disinterest in talking to them. And if you make him talk to them, then you know, who knows how that story is going to come out, you know, and
what's he going to say?
Yeah. And in hindsight. So well done there. So there was already an officer in, you know, nearby in the lot. He gets there. I assume you called 911 and he responded.
I did.
Okay, yep. And how much did you call tell them? On. Go ahead. What did you tell them on the phone?
Basically told them that I either almost got robbed or something along those lines, and I had to draw my gun. Basically, they said, you know, don't have the gun in your hand when the police show up, which I didn't, which I reholstered right before I dialed 911, obviously. But he got there so quick that it could have been, you know, that way. But I was on the phone with him when he pulled up. So basically I just told him that I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I think I just almost got robbed and almost had a gun drawn on me, that kind of thing.
Yeah. The next point I wanted to make, sorry, before I forget, is almost always where there's a robbery where they're trying to get close to you enough to do what they're going to do. There will always be a line, an opening line. Do you have a light? Do you know what time it is? You know, anything, can I get a ride from you, whatever. And the purpose of those phrases, in my opinion, whether the bad guy knows it or not, is to make their potential victim feel comfortable enough that this isn't a robbery. So, oh, he just needs a light or a cigarette or some change or whatever. And the idea behind that, and again, I'm not giving the bad guys credit that they actually think this through. They just sort of a natural thing to do is to close that reactionary gap that gives you the options that you want to have enough to where they can get close enough to you to do whatever it is they want to do. And in Mike's case, this is a great lesson. He said he wasn't having any of that. He's like, hey, stop. And he recognized this was potentially a threat, potentially a problem. And he says, no, stop. Let the bad guy know two things. One, I see you. And two, not today. Not me. I'm the wrong guy. You picked the wrong victim. And giving him that impression early on, it is always the right thing to do, in my opinion, unless you're so greatly overmatched. If there's 10 of them and they all have machetes, well, that's a different story. But in this case, I think it was perfect thing for you to do was to acknowledge his presence and tell him, no, you're not going to get that close to me. This is not going to go the way you thought it was. I'm not your victim today.
Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. So the officer shows up. You have holstered your pistol at this point and kind of had, oh, I meant to ask, did he run away? Did he get into a car or did you see where he went when he left?
He ran.
Okay.
Last I saw him, he was running through the McDonald's parking lot toward my left, which would have been north on Getwell. And I lost sight of him at that point.
He was late for that interview with the law firm, probably. So yes. He had to go.
He ran much, much faster than I would have expected he could have in the jeans that were very baggy and not being held up very well.
Yeah, I don't want to give away any secrets, but the police love that you wear clothes that fall down around your ankles when you're trying to run away. Yeah. So keep that up. Please keep doing that. Or when you're running from us at night and you have those shoes with little lights that light up, that's also very helpful. So those are
the
we call those the felony flyers. Anyway, so the officer rolls up and kind of walk us through what happened then.
He gets out. I go up to him and I basically tell him what happened. And I did actually say, I said, I am armed. I said, if you want to take it, you can. He didn't have any reason to. He said he didn't think that was necessary. And he told me just, you know, don't pull it out.
Yeah,
of course. We went through the whole thing. He got on the radio, put out a description of what was going on. And then he wanted me to write a statement and the whole bit. And in the process of talking to him, I started to worry that maybe I was going to wind up being hemmed up because I didn't actually see a gun. Like, I didn't actually get a gun drawn on me, and I wound up drawn on this guy. That was my main concern once I really started kind of playing it through my head. And I'm talking to the officer, and he said not to worry about that. He said, you know, if he made you think that he had a gun, he literally asked me, were you afraid for your life? And I said, yeah, I really was. And he said, then you have nothing to worry about.
Well, it's like anything else. And I think just talking about how you articulate something like this, or whether you articulated at the time or not, because you know, you just had a critical incident, frankly, something that could have gone very poorly. The question is, what would a reasonable person think about what a reasonable person do? Reasonable officer in the case of law enforcement, reasonable person is approached by this person. You yell at them twice to stop. They don't stop. That's not normal behavior. They then reach for your door handle. For what possible reason are they reaching for your door handle? And then he says something like, whatever he said, I got something for you. I got something for that. I think as long as you articulate those things, you're fine. But I totally understand in that moment, like, wait, you're now second guessing yourself. Was I right in what I did? Am I in trouble now? Did I just commit aggravated assault by pointing a gun at somebody?
Right.
And so I'm sure those things were all going through your head at the time. Am I right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. So I start writing out my statement, basically telling, you know, what happened. Maybe 15, 20, but within a half an hour, roughly, another police car rolls up and they've got the guy in the back of the car and he's cuffed. And basically I said, is this him? I'm like, that is him. And still being a little worried about the whole, you know, I didn't see a gun kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The officer that drove up with him, I said, hey, did he have a gun on him? And they said, no, he didn't. And I, at the time, thought, oh, here we go.
Right.
But he said, don't worry about it. He goes, he's known to us. You know, we've taken guns off him before. He actually wound up having, I think it was two warrants that were active for him at the time. And the one thing that the one officer said to me that I will remember forever, he said, we're pretty sure he had a gun when you saw him and he ditched it someplace and we're looking for it right now.
Nice.
So, but he said he wasn't bright enough not to ditch the bag of weed that he had on him. So we got him for that too. And I was like, okay, whatever. And they did actually wind up finding a gun that I believe he pitched over a fence or something. Mm-hmm. They did wind up somehow tying it back to him. I don't remember if he was charged with that or not. I don't know how that all played out. And I was actually, you know, expecting to go to court for the whole thing and everything. I got interviewed a couple times by a lawyer. I can't remember who it was, but he wound up pleading, taking a lower plea deal or something like that. And I think, if I remember right, he got sentenced to 3 to 4 years, something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. He didn't serve nearly that amount of time.
No, of course not.
So it was, you know, it was an interesting experience. I would prefer it not if it happened again. And the one thing that I remember specifically, I don't remember exactly where in the whole process of things that happened. It was while I was at the gas pump and everything was kind of happening. I remember distinctly the thought going through my head. I just came here to get coffee. Mm-hmm. All I wanted to do was buy some coffee. And then, you know, the whole day changed. And I wound up, I got back to work like, God, I don't know, two hours, something like that, later than I should have. My boss was wondering where the heck I was.
Right.
Told him the whole story. You know, his whole thing was, did you wind up shooting the guy? And I was like, no. And he was an interesting character. And he wanted to know why. And I was like, because I don't want to kill anybody. What are you out of your mind? And, you know, but it was, you know, interesting way to start 2009 for sure. And if it never happens again, I'm totally cool with it.
Yeah. I mean, that's, well, what do we say all the time? What does John say on the channel? Good, sane, sober, moral, prudent people. And a moral person, a prudent person, wouldn't shoot anyone unnecessarily. But it's funny that you got that, hey, why don't you just blow them away, you know, kind of attitude from your boss at the time. But I'm glad that you didn't. I can only assume, first of all, it doesn't surprise me as former law enforcement that they knew exactly who this guy was. I'm sure they probably, from your description, knew, oh, that's Frank, you know, or whatever his name is. That's probably him. And we know where he's going to be. They knew exactly which church was having an ice cream social and knew exactly where to go to intercept him before he got there. Just a guess.
Absolutely.
You know, Mike, sometimes these stories are just as straightforward as possible, and yours really is pretty straightforward. But I have to ask, after this happened, are you then, every time you're getting gas or every time you go to a big box store or whatever, are you replaying this? Are you thinking about it? Or is it just like, well, this happened, it went well, and we're good?
I would say for a short period of time after that it happened, I would, it would pop into my head occasionally when we would go to a store or a gas station, something like that. It never really bothered me in the respect what I would consider some, like a PTS kind of a mm-hmm. thing. I think I may have had one or two dreams about it, but they weren't, you know, nightmares or that kind of thing. It was just, oh, I had a dream about it. No, I mean, it certainly had an effect. But I wouldn't call it a detrimental effect. If anything, it might have made me a little bit more situationally aware. And I'll be honest with you. I think one of the worst things that's happened to society in the last couple of years are these stupid gas pumps that play TV commercials.
Or having your cell phone in front of your face. Yeah. By the way, those are, never mind the public safety aspect of those. They're just absolutely the most annoying thing of all time. It's never anything I'm interested in looking at in the first place. And I'm trying to talk to someone in the backseat of the car, and the thing is blaring in my ear, talking about the top 10 croissant recipes for 2024 or whatever. I don't care, and I don't need to be entertained at the gas pump. I need to be paying attention.
Well, for future reference, the top right-hand corner and the second from the top button is generally a mute button. It's not marked, but if you hit it, it's a mute button for those.
Oh, good to know. See, that's...
I figured that out because I hate them.
Folks, if you've tuned in today for a lesson, I think that's the one you want to take away, is look for that mute button at the gas pump, because that is so irritating. I want to get one thing out of my system now, too, while there's just literally thousands of people tuned into this podcast. If you are at a big box store gas station, Costco, Sam's Club, whatever you have in your area that has the discount gas, and you have just waited, oh, I don't know, 25 minutes in line to get to a gas pump. If you then dawdle up to that gas pump, sit in your car for a minute, checking your texts, get out, fumble for your club card, fumble for your credit card, and then realize, oh no, I parked too far away to get the handle all the way around to the other side of my car, and then have to move your car and then get gas. And then at the end, get back in your car and check your emails and not even a foot on the brake for another 2 minutes. You're a terrible person, and I don't want you to listen to my show anymore. anymore because I'm behind you. I'm in the F1 pit stop mentality. Like, okay, we're gonna get out. I got the Costco card in this hand, debit card in this hand, gas pump. You know, the little door has already been opened to get gas, and we're ready to go. And I got this guy ahead of me. All right, now I said that out loud. I can feel a little bit better. Mike, was there anything you wanted to add before we let you go? I don't want to miss anything.
No, I would just say reiterate to everybody. Don't be on your phone when you're in a situation like that. Don't pay attention to the gas pump music or TV show or whatever's playing. Watch what's going on around you.
And if you haven't seen John's, he's had more than one. There's a YouTube short, I think, and there's maybe a longer one about playing the four corners game at the gas pump, which is literally keep moving around, keep your eyes peeled. Don't get in your car and get on your phone, because when you get out of your car, there could be somebody there who wasn't there when you got in your car. So be careful about that. And folks, last thing, do me a favor. This only happens when I mention it, so I'll mention it again today. If you haven't yet rated or reviewed the podcast on whatever service you're watching on, if you're watching this on the app, leave a comment. Tell my bosses how great I am and how much you enjoy the content. If you're on Apple Podcasts, you can leave a rating review. Spotify, I think you can leave a star review, or rather nothing narrative, but you can leave 5 stars or whatever. And what that does is that makes it so that Spotify, Apple Podcasts, they recommend this podcast to more people so that more people tune in and listen. Because I think what we're doing here is good work. We're giving people real, legitimate, practical, everyday advice for how to keep themselves safe. So if you want that to be perpetuated, do me that favor and take a moment and rate it and review it. I thank you ahead of time. Mike, I can't thank you enough for reaching out and being willing to share your story. You were one of the most articulate guests I've had, and I really appreciate the fact that I have very little editing to do when we're done here. Well done, sir. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you very much.